Thank you, John. It's really, I only come for an extended period to Santa Barbara, it seems like once every 10 years on average. So this is my trip during my 50s, okay? And it made me think about time. And since we're talking about superconductors, also temperature. And as everyone knows, those two are related. And so that's what I'm going to talk about today, 5 decades of temperature and time. And I've done a box here. And the horizontal axis is temperature, ranging from 10 to the minus 3 Kelvin down here up to 10 to the 2 Kelvin. So that makes 5 decades. Okay. And on the horizontal axis, I've used the alternate interpretation of decade, meaning time, and every 10 years. So around 30 years ago, I was here as a postdoc, and in the spring of 1986, we had a workshop on heavy fermion superconductivity. I think it was in the spring of 1986. There was a whole bunch of new superconductors discovered around that time at around 1 Kelvin, okay, in TC. So that sets the center of the scale here. But what I'd like to do is to give you a little bit of history and tell you about some of the enduring mysteries of this field, which we're gathered here at Santa Barbara to try and solve. I think it's always very useful to look at the history because it gives you a perspective. And one of the things you usually learn when you look back in history is that there were moments of brilliance and moments when everyone was terribly lost and terribly confused. And in fact, that was the majority of the time. And it's useful to gain some perspective. So rather interesting to take you back in time to, and interrupt me, right, to the fall of to the year of 1960, which is 5 decades ago. Roughly speaking. And a whole group of people gathered independently in Berkeley, around Berkeley, and they were fascinated by the extension of the ideas of BCS theory to other fermionic fluids. And so 4 different groups with Berkeley connections, except for one with a Moscow connection, came up with the idea that helium-3 might well go superfluid. And they made a bunch of predictions, and I'll tell you about those predictions, but in terms of TC, their estimates were somewhere around here, okay? Around the 0.1 Kelvin mark, from 100 millikelvin down to about 20 millikelvin, okay? It's rather interesting, these groups, there was Pitayevsky, actually in 1959 in Moscow. There was David Thouless, who was visiting the Lawrence Berkeley Livermore Lab. Interestingly enough, you didn't know that. There was a group, Bruckner, the nuclear physicist, Soda, Anderson, and Morell. And last but not least, there was Emery, who was a postdoc, I believe, or maybe even a graduate student at Berkeley, okay? And so these people here were all in Berkeley, interestingly enough. This one was at the Kapitz Institute in Moscow. Anderson was at Bell Labs. And anyone know where Morell was? No, yeah, he was, dead on. He was at the French Consulate of New York City. That was his official address, okay, doing his military service. And all of these people came to the conclusion that helium-3 will go superfluid, just like its partner, helium-4. They had looked at the nuclear interaction, put in their best bet for the nuclear interaction, and concluded that the attracted channel was L equals 2 D wave. All of them, okay? And that TC would be somewhere in the range of 50 to 100 millikelvin. That was what they came up with. A beautiful work. And in fact, although they believed it was going to be D-wave, the field pushed ahead with other generalizations of anisotropic pairing. And so already by 1961, Morell and Anderson had proposed an interesting state, interesting P-wave state, L equals 1. And they weren't quite clear what to apply it to. Okay. In 1965, it's relevant to here in Santa Barbara, Walter Cohn and Quinn Littinger explored the idea of anisotropic pairing, came to the conclusion that Friedel oscillations will induce pairing in some channel, and they worked out in the kind of continuum, and they wrote down a marvelous formula, which I will write for you. It was an asymptotic formula, so I'm going to put this was Cohn and Luttinger's formula. Cohn and Luttinger would get together at Bell Labs in the summer. They'd be funded by Bell Labs to do research there. And this was one of their projects that they did in 1965 when they collaborated together. And this was their asymptotic formula for the TC induced by Friedel oscillations. Okay, and so because they knew that everyone was interested in D-wave, they plugged in L equals 2 and they got TC equals 10 to the minus 17 EF. Okay? But what's curious, and they didn't do this, is that had they been bold enough to plug in L equals 1 into their formula, they would have got TC equals 0.05 EF, which is, again, roughly this number here. Anyway, so as the decade went on...
So Pierce, Ellis 2 and so forth. I guess they departed from the bare van der Waals interactions?
They didn't do very much, actually. They departed from the van der Waals. This was for electronic media here they were doing. Okay, so it wasn't nuclear matter anymore. Yeah, yeah. Right? And during this time, there was two physicists, Fay and Laser, who realized that ferromagnetic fluctuations would actually enhance P-wave pairing. And that was around 1970. Of course, helium-3 did go superfluid, and the discovery of the superfluidity at Cornell by Richardson, Osheroff, and guys soon gave the evidence that showed that this phase was actually a P-wave superconductor. Interestingly enough, they named the phases they discovered A and B because they discovered A first and discovered B second. Okay. Curiously, however, this is a quirk of history, the A phase, we now know, is a P-wave state described by a paired state discovered by Anderson and Morell in 1961. So we call it A, we think, because of Anderson, but it's actually because they got it. It was A first. And the other phase, which is the fully gapped phase of helium-3b, has a beautiful isotropic Fermi surface. And this phase was actually predicted theoretically by Roger Balian and Wurthammer in 1965, and they mentioned mercury when they wrote down this wave function. They were thinking of mercury, not of helium-3. But curiously, these two theory papers applied to helium-3b, and we now think of it as a P-wave superconductor. But the theorists predicted it, but they predicted it with the wrong symmetry. Okay. Nevertheless, it's a pretty amazing story, I would say. Okay. So I think there was a general feeling around this time that if electronic systems did go superconductor, it'd be incredibly low temperatures. And there were lots of misconceptions at the time based on the understanding of conventional phonon-based superconductivity, which, as we know, is produced by a retarded interaction mediated by phonons. And already by 1960, the highest TC superconductor was somewhere around here on log scale, around 20 Kelvin niobium 3 selenide. Okay. And actually, you can take basic lead, hardware store quality lead. You can't buy much lead at the hardware store now, but in the old days you could, and it goes superconducting. But if you add a little bit of magnetic moments into it, TC plummets. This is a basic principle established by phonon-based superconductors, which is that magnetism is bad. That's to say, ferro or local moment magnetism is bad. And so, if you studied magnets at that time, you didn't ever imagine they could go superconducting. So in fact, in 1973, a group at Bell Labs was studying a bunch of beryllium-13 compounds and studied uranium-beryllium-13, along with cerium-beryllium-13 and a whole bunch of other systems. And they were really interested in antiferromagnets. And it really tells you about, it was actually 1974. In 1974, this is Buch et al., PRB 11440, 1975. And this is, so you can read it yourself. But what they said was, we tried to detect any possible magnetic ordering below 1 Kelvin. Instead, we found a sharp superconducting transition at 0.95 Kelvin, which was reduced by about 0.3 Kelvin in a field of 60 kiloerths, 6 Tesla. Okay? And this suggests that the superconductivity is not an intrinsic property of uranium-beryllium-13. End of statement, end of research, sample sent to Berkeley to have its specific heat capacity measurement, but the individual in charge of the sample was more interested in spin glasses, so he never got round to it. And so the discovery didn't actually occur, and so we can erase it from then, and it wasn't until 1983 it was discovered, rediscovered. And by then, another material had already been discovered somewhere around here, cerium copper 2 silicon 2 by Frank Steglich, and he had fought hard with Matthias to establish the reliability of his measurements. Okay. And one of the measurements that's very important for a superconductor is specific heat capacity. And I mentioned specific heat capacity because we often forget that this is one of the most beautiful methods of spectroscopy. Measuring the amount of heat it takes to thermalize quantum states is a way of probing the Hilbert space. In fact, loosely speaking, the specific heat you get out is a measure of the entanglement entropy that's present in the ground state. Okay. And so, in fact, what Steglich did in 1979 was that he measured the specific heat capacity of cerium, copper 2, silicon 2. And these systems had very large linear specific heats. This is around 500 times that of copper. And as you know, the integral of CV dt over T up to some temperature, say TC, is a measure of the entanglement entropy of the superconductor. It wasn't called that then, that's right, Chip, but I thought I'd modernize it, right? And in fact, this system has something around 0.1, about 0.1 or 0.05 R log 2, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it's actually huge given the tiny temperature scale at which it goes superconducting. And this convinced people that the heavy electrons that were present in this material were actually pairing. Okay. And so this brings us up to 30 years ago here in Santa Barbara, where we were all discussing these things. It wasn't in this building then, but we would get together in Bob Schrieffer's office. Doug Scalapino would come along, and it would feel very, very funny because Doug was like the postdoc and I was like the urchin just sitting down there, and Bob was listening in, and there were a lot of discussions about D-wave pairing at that time, in fact. And in fact, some of those discussions led to the paper that Doug wrote in 1986, discussing the link of antiferromagnetism and D-wave pairing. In fact, there were three papers written around this time on that link, one by Bourbonnais and others in Canada and France, one by Miyake Schmidt-Rink and Chandravarma at Bell Labs. And they all came to the same conclusion based on one material, uranium platinum 3, which was shown to have antiferromagnetic fluctuations, that antiferromagnetic fluctuations drive D-way pairing. Okay? And what's curious is that when in the fall or December of that year, it was announced that lanthanum cuprate 214 with barium was superconducting somewhere around 30 Kelvin, this took the world by surprise and divided the community tremendously. Most of the people in New Jersey felt that as TC went up, and it went very rapidly, so that by February of 1987, one had a terbium barium cuprate. And by the mid-90s, this had gone up in the pressurized version of the mercury compound, barium copper, calcium copper oxide. This goes at 30 gigapascal. This goes up to 160 at the highest temperature. And so it was felt in the early days, at least on the east coast, that these things had to be extended S-wave superconductors, mainly because the belief was that anything else would be very susceptible to disorder, and TC would go down very rapidly. There were a few who believed that it was probably D-wave. Doug was one of them. My colleague Gabby Kotliar was sitting on the bench, wasn't quite sure, worked out RVB theory, came to the conclusion it predicted D-wave pairing, and was almost embarrassed about it because, you know, it wasn't the dictate of the time. Nevertheless, it turns out, in fact, that we now know these are D-wave superconductors. These systems are a mix of D and P and F, all sorts of different anisotropic pairing going on there. Ironically, the material that led to the prediction that antiferromagnetism drives D-wave pairing is now known to be a triplet superconductor. It's an F-wave superconductor, as far as we know. So it was good motivation, but it turns out that if you'd applied that particular theory to that particular compound, you'd got it wrong, in fact. Right? So, moving to the modern era, and really the topic of this workshop here, we have families of superconductors that we're desperately trying to understand. We have the cuprates, we have the organics, we have the heavy fermion superconductors, and most recently, joining this crowd, the ion-based superconductors. These were discovered in 86, 79, probably 73, but really wasn't verified until much later, and 2008 by Hosono. So,
talking about the actinides.
Yeah, I would put them in this general group because I put 73. I got this mixed up. This is 73. This is 79. The first actinide was 83. Well, although we met, we learned a few weeks ago that one old uranium superconductor believed to be a phonon-based superconductor has now been reclassified as an electronically-based superconductor. It was known years ago. So I don't know what, I mean, obviously these materials have been known for a very long time, and of course in this class we also have to put up here magnesium diboride, which was discovered around the year 2000. And has something around 40 Kelvin transition temperature, and this is part of the arc of the phonon-based superconductors. So I wanted to tell you a little bit about these various systems, and one of the images that you might want to take away from this is the fact that, in fact, this is the era of magnetism and superconductivity. It's quite clear to us that spin degrees of freedom and magnetism are part of the story driving these superconductors. And we don't entirely know how, but so that in contrast to the exchange of fluctuations, phonon fluctuations, we know that magnetism is somehow important, and there's various phase diagrams that you can draw. They all look roughly the same. Let me give you the basic phase diagram of the cuprate superconductors. Here is tea, and here is doping. And this is holes, and this is electrons. Most of the activity in the early days was in hole doping, and somewhere around 300 Kelvin, these systems are anti-ferromagnets in the undoped case, but as you dope them, the anti-ferromagnetism comes down, and TC comes up. And on the other side, a rather similar thing happens. It's not symmetric, and you get a rather smaller superconducting dome on the electron doped sides. Okay? Similar things to this are seen in other materials, in the heavy electron materials. There's a whole bunch of systems that were anti-ferromagnets. Instead of doping them, you can apply pressure to them. And as you apply pressure, the anti-ferromagnetism comes down. And lo and behold, as you hit zero, superconductivity comes up. And this would be the phase diagram of the material cerium, rhodium, indium 5. And so this is an antiferromagnet. This is an antiferromagnet, local moment antiferromagnet. And the nictides, they're not so very different. The iron arsenic and also the iron chalcogenides, they have a spin density wave dome around zero doping, and superconductivity kind of appears around the boundaries of this. Spin density wave because they're more delocalized, the magnetism here. Okay? But in all these cases, it's superconductivity on the brink of magnetism. And the debate is not about whether magnetism is important. It's about the details of how the magnetism drives the superconductivity, how the Hilbert space of the spins is incorporated into the superconducting condensate, whether you can extend the idea of phonon exchange to magnon exchange and have a weak coupling picture, or whether you require a new picture to understand the superconductivity. And this is where the debate is raging. And in fact, the truth lies somewhere in between, presumably. And there are a lot of mysteries out there that we can't understand at the moment. And I wanted to tell you a few of those mysteries before we end today. In the case of the... Yes?
Sorry.
Yeah, please.
In the cuprate phase diagram on the whole doped side, did you really mean to have the superconductivity and antiferromagnetism overlapping like that?
You know, it was done very quickly. And so you should interpret my diagrams at that level of accuracy.
Okay.
But I assure you, there are physicists around who will say they have samples in which they do coexist, although the general consensus is that they don't. Okay. Right. Okay. And I also forgot to mention the huge pseudogap dome, which goes up like this. Okay. And the nature of the quiescent order in these phases in connection with superconductivity is a major element of discussion. Because time is running, let me tell you about some of the mysteries that are out there, which we are all trying to understand. It won't be exhaustive, it will just be a very rapid view. And before I finish, what I want to do is to bring you back down to the millikelvin regime and tell you the meaning of this triangle here. Yes?
Have any of these superconducting materials been predicted yet? Or are they all...
Have they all been predicted?
Theories posted?
I'm trying to think if there's a good example of a predicted one. It's probably not.
No,
is the answer.
No,
I think Marvin Coyne at some point back in the 60s
yes.
predicted one of the S waves, the phonon mediated superconductor.
Yeah.
And that's a famous example. Well, not famous.
Okay, so what you can do is you can, once you discover a family, you can generalize. Okay? And some of the generalizations that have come about have been truly remarkable. In particular, I wanted to tell you about this particular family of materials that were connected to some of my mysteries. In fact, this was in some sense a predicted material. Okay? Why? Because, in fact, in the mid-90s, stimulated by the work in the cuprates, it was realized that two-dimensionality, as you go two-dimensional, can help superconductivity. In particular, even the simplest theories, you can fit a D-wave paired state very nicely around the two-dimensional Fermi surface in a way that it doesn't like to fit around a three-dimensional Fermi surface. And so, furthermore, the idea that magnetism if you drove it critical, could enhance the glue amongst the electrons, was also an interesting idea. And so at the Cambridge group in the mid-90s, Lonsarich came up with the idea that maybe if you squeezed antiferromagnets, you could drive them superconducting. Okay? And so he took cerium indium 3, which was a well-known 40 Kelvin antiferromagnet, and he squeezed it in a pressure cell. And the phase diagram that he got looked rather like this, excepting it had this tiny little glitch of 0.2 Kelvin superconductivity at the bottom. So it confirmed the idea, albeit in a not a terribly impressive way. And then the idea came around the year 2000, why not take this cubic system, basically a cuboid of indium atoms surrounding a cerium ion, why not make it more two-dimensional? Why not put in some layers here of whatever you can get in, and they put in rhodium, indium 2 layers. And then this is work that was done at Florida, at the High Magnetic Field Lab, that Zachary Fisk. And then TC of the TNAL went down to 5 Kelvin, and when they put pressure on it, it went superconducting at 2.5 Kelvin. And then the idea was, well, okay, so how will we get TC up? First of all, we can put some pressure on it. Let's try cerium cobalt indium 5. And that didn't even need any pressure. That has a TC of 2.5 Kelvin. And it has many properties in common with the cuprate superconductors. It has a linear resistivity. It's got a strange metal phase. And it has the peculiar property that if you turn on a magnetic field and create a Hall current, so the Hall current decays at a different rate to the charge current. It decays with a T squared behavior, one of the mysteries of these systems. Anyway, then someone said, well, okay, let's boost TC by making the bandwidth larger. And the way to do that is to go from 4F to 5F. And so they made the same stuff and they replaced this with plutonium. Then you had to replace this with gallium. And TC went up to 18.5 Kelvin. This is the only example I know where it's not predicted in the sense that someone pressed a computer, but where reasoning based on chemistry and our understanding of the physics led to a family of superconductors with TCs ranging over two decades of temperature. So that's a partial answer to your question.
Is it, I guess it's clear to you experts, but why does TC go up with the nuclear mass?
It's not the nuclear mass that's important. It's that the bandwidth of the F bands is bigger for actinides than for rare earths. Mm-hmm. And so that's where the factor of 10 comes from in TC. Mm-hmm. So we would love to be able to do the same thing with our other families of superconductors. This arise here.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How about BKBO?
BKBO, that's a good point. This is a system that's somewhere around 1 Kelvin, which is an oxide. Right, discovered in the 70s.
I think barium lead is with oxide was about 12.
Yes.
But then Hammond, some other kind of older cuprate idea, they decided not to dope in the layer where
yes.
the carriers were, to just dope off the potassium.
Yes.
It went to what, 30 Kelvin?
30 Kelvin, yes. Yeah.
Kind of in line with what you're saying.
So I think once you've found a family, then you found an island and you can explore around it. And that's been very successful. The main problem is that we don't know how to find other islands. That's been our difficulty. From a theoretical point of view, there are a number of questions about the behavior of the normal state and the nature of the pairing. Let me just, to keep things complete, mention one of the very weirdest things of the cuprates, which is that if you look at the resistivity versus temperature, then from their base temperature, which is 30 to 100 Kelvin, resistivity just roars on up linearly up to 1,000 Kelvin. Now, you can argue about the details of how linear it is, but that's what it looks like at optimal doping. And what's very odd, it doesn't saturate where it really ought to. And you don't see the phonons there. And the other weird thing about it is that you can define another scattering rate from looking at something called the Hall angle, which is the ratio of rho xy over rho xx. And when you plot that versus t, it's not straight. If you plot it versus t squared, it is a nice straight line. And a metal in which the Hall currents, which is the precession of the current around the Fermi surface, decay at a different rate to the decay of the linear currents, is quite mysterious. And this behavior is also seen, which is seen in the cuprates, and also in cerium cobalt, indium 5. I learned last week that there are some interface systems here at Santa Barbara which show the same behavior. It's very interesting. Okay. Another mystery that I want to mention is the way the spins are incorporated into the superconductor, and on this scale of 115, which as I mentioned goes from 0.2 Kelvin with cerium aluminium 3 to about 2 Kelvin for cerium cobalt indium 5 to about 18.5 Kelvin for plutonium cobalt gallium 5. There's another member of this series, which is the neptunium system, which was not predicted, was actually made by accident. It was a physicist had neptunium in a palladium crucible, and it reacted with it and produced neptunium palladium 5 aluminium 2. This has got a 5 Kelvin transition. When you look at the magnetic susceptibility of this system, it's rather remarkable. It's a beautiful Curie vice curve right down to when it goes superconducting, when it goes to minus 1 over 4 pi. This is the susceptibility of this material. Okay. And so there are local moments at high temperatures, and they just disappear as it goes superconducting. This is the antithesis of the idea that magnetism is bad. This is a system where the magnetic degrees of freedom haven't even organized into an antiferromagnet or a spin liquid before they go superconducting. And furthermore, when we look at the specific heat capacity of this system, it has a huge anomaly, and the area under this curve here is around a third R log 2. That's about a third of the spin entropy of the local moments going into the condensate. And it raises the question of how do the spins, which are neutral objects, entangle with the electrons to create charged pairs? Okay? And so one of the ideas, which has been explored and has a history going on, this system, it's a Cramer's doublet. It's not a natural spin a half. But it's got that amount of entropy. Yeah. One of the ideas that's been put forward, and in fact, the originators of this, a whole bunch of people in the 90s, is the idea that you might form a composite pair. And a composite pair is really the combination of a spin flip with a Cooper pair. Something like that. A triplet pair bound to a spin. This idea began to be looked at in the early 90s by Emery and Kivelson in the context of the two-channel Condo model. A little bit more recently, Schrieffer, Balatsky, Scalapino, and Abrahams thought about it in the context of a weird thing called odd-frequency pairing. And we think this kind of pairing might be going on in this system here, in this neptunium system, and signs that it's also occurring in parallel with magnetically mediated pairing in these other systems. And this brings me, as I close, to the apparently least impressive member. I've got two other mysteries, but I probably won't get to all of them. I think I'll stop with this one last discussion here, which is this material down here, ytterbium, rhodium 2, silicon 2. It has the magnificent phase transition temperature of 2 millikelvin. And it illustrates, in some sense, the principle brought out by Luttinger and Cohn, that all metals sooner or later have to go superconducting, right? And so you might say, well, great, you know, if you cool it enough, everything ultimate and purified will go superconducting. How long do you want to spend research dollars on cooling things down, right? And this system, which goes superconducting at 2 millikelvin, has a big surprise in it. It's very hard to cool the system down to 2 millikelvin. We heard a talk on this just 2 weeks ago at the meeting by a fellow called Erwin Schubert, who works in Munich and can cool electron gases down to half a millikelvin with his methods. And it's very hard to measure specific heat capacity at these temperatures because the moment you touch it, you warm it up. Okay? And so they devise a very clever way of doing this by putting a tiny amount of heat in, watching the magnetization relax with time and converting magnetization into temperature rise. And the phase diagram that they have discovered of this material at low temperatures is very interesting, and once again, it has a phase diagram which has an A and a B phase on it. Who knows, maybe there's some theorists who've already predicted the physics of this, and this is what the phase diagram looks like from a paper of theirs in Physicus Datus Solidi. It looks like this, and it's labeled B and A. Okay, A goes out here, and B goes up to 10 millikelvin, and this is 2 millikelvin, and this is 4 millitesla. This field going out this way. Okay. This up here, the electrons have formed a very, very weak antiferromagnet. Okay. But what's surprising is that they find that as they cool down, the magnetization takes a remarkable dip at 2 millikelvin. And it seems to be diamagnetism going on. They haven't ever attached leads to it because they can't, so they don't know it's superconducting. But they can also look at the specific heat capacity, and they've measured that, and there's early data on this which aren't published yet that looks something like this. And whereas in copper, this thing would be around one, copper doesn't go superconducting, but copper, if we're at magnetic order, this would be around 1 millijoule per mole Kelvin. Whereas in the heavy electrons, this would be around 1 joule or 1,000 millijoules per mole per Kelvin squared. This system clocks in at 1 million millijoules per mole Kelvin squared. And when you integrate the area here, as they say in their Physica Statis Solidi paper, in which they thought it was a magnetic phase transition at first, this is around 1/3 R log 2. Now down at 2 millikelvin, there isn't much entropy left in the electron fluid. So where does this entropy come from? And the answer is, it's nuclear entropy. It's the entropy of the ytterbium nuclei, we believe, okay? It's very early days for this, and the data could go away, and they haven't done the measurements in isotopically pure versions of the material, so this might be a misinterpretation. But it seems good at the moment. We don't know whether the nuclei are following the shell. They're responding to an electronic superconductivity, a measly little thing, in some unusual way, or whether they're leading the shell, whether they're giving their Hilbert space to the superconducting condensate. But I think the second one is by far the most likely scenario, and there are other reasons for believing this. So if true, this will be an example, a very nice example, of this kind of composite pairing, only with the nuclear spins coupled via the hyperfine interaction to the conduction electrons entangling to form a superconductor. And you have to watch this space, because we don't know whether it's going to go away or not. It's a very radical result. But if it's true, it won't give us high-temperature superconductors, but it may give us a very new perspective on the ways in which spins and magnetism can drive superconductivity. Okay, that's it.
You see within that the Sundine scale of superconductivity is set by J, the magnetism J. I don't know. Maybe it does. So, but what is the highest J material known, which is two-dimensional?
J being maybe the magnetic interaction.
Yeah.
Inside.
Sorry.
But of course, in all of these things, because superconductivity at some level will involve a running coupling constant, you've got this game of large bandwidths with very weak J's and small bandwidths with very large J's, which could all be giving the same low energy physics.
Yes.
So, but obviously the largest J's that we know would be the cuprate superconductors, where J is running around 1,000 Kelvin plus there, and is somehow connected with the pseudo gap phase as you go to zero doping, right? But I think maybe that's not the right number to give you. I think actually what makes a high temperature superconductor, you should define a dimensionless quantity. After all, you can go to quark or plasmas and the interior of neutron stars, and the scales are much, much bigger there. And you'd call that, would you, should you call that a high temperature superconductor?
No,
superconductor.
About actual, okay. Then you care about actual numbers.
So then okay, yeah, sure. So then the cuprates would be the best example. The nictides are coming up then, and we don't entirely understand. I had one more point on here. These are the nictide superconductors here, and I didn't have much time to talk about them today, but there is a number of one that's up at an interface superconductor up at 100 Kelvin in an iron selenide system. So that would also be an example of a very large J. So I think that there are two angles that come in here. One is the practical application angle, how big is your TC? Okay? But you might look for a dimensionless quantity, and one such quantity would be the entropy of condensation. So from that perspective, this easily guy down here at 2 millikelvin, and this guy up here, 160 millikelvin, are in the same league. They use the same amount of quantum mechanical Hilbert space in forming their superconductor. It's just that their scales are very, very different. And that then gives you an idea that for getting high TC at some brute force level, which is the question of getting your interaction scales up. Of course, it might be that there are different ways of doing that.
Can phonons and spins cooperate to get even higher TC?
Why not? I mean, no, we don't know of any examples. And part of the problem is that they're very different kinds of superconductor. One is very highly retarded, and S-wave. And the other one is more instantaneous, and therefore the cancellations against quantum interaction are usually driven, we think, by nodes in the wave function. So to put those two together is very difficult. One is S-wave, one is maybe not S-wave, but perhaps it could happen. If the nictides are S plus minus pairing, then there might be some way of connecting them up with the phonons somehow. But no one has come up with a concrete idea of how to make that work. But ideas of tandem pairing, of two machines working together to push the TC up, is obviously in the air. We can only find good ways of doing that.
So 20 years ago, when the cuprates were new, there was some group theory, SO5. I don't know how it applied. I don't work in this stuff. But did that ever pan out, or is that a dead end, using group theory to discuss this?
Well, its stocks went very high for a while. and some of those who have who proposed the idea of doing extremely well in their science career. So I think that's one way of answering the question.
But they're not invited to the KITP, is that right?
They come very often to the KITP.
Okay.
I think it's very important to understand that in theoretical physics, I think we're doomed to mostly fail, okay? And I think most of the proposals should not be graded on whether they failed or succeeded, but on the level of creativity and the effort to move the paradigm forward that went into that. And so SO5 is a beautiful example of a wonderful, wonderfully creative idea that might have worked, but doesn't seem to work in detail, I think, but nevertheless, may well stimulate other future theories about the idea of how hidden symmetries may be connected with the intertwined nature of the order. And so sons of SO5, or daughters of SO5, are under active consideration in context, for example, of the pseudo-gap phase of the cuprates. And so it's not an idea that disappeared, although its direct application, thinking of magnetism and superconductivity, perhaps as running under one beautiful symmetry group, didn't quite pan out, I think, in the models that it was applied to originally. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Pierce, can you say something about copper?
Copper.
Yeah, when will it become superconductor?
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's right. You know, It's a good question. No, copper has been caught in incredibly low temperatures, and it undergoes nuclear magnetism at temperatures like a nanoKelvin. Yet no one ever saw any superconductivity, but at those temperatures you probably can't detect the superconductivity if it's there. So it might have, they might have gone into P-wave superconducting states without anyone knowing. Yes?
I think somewhere around 1970, John Clark tried to answer this question. What he did was he put lead on copper and studied the proximity effect. And I think his conclusion from the induced superconductivity in the copper from the lead was that the lead superconducting temperature would not go superconducting.
Yeah. As an S-wave superconducting.
The copper would not go under, I agree with you.
Yeah.
Go another way.
It might find another way.
Under the lead, at least. He could.
Sure. So the mu star in copper may well be big enough that it can never form an S-wave superconductor. But that wouldn't preclude the possibility of very feeble, higher angular momentum paired states forming at lower temperatures. And if it likes to go magnetic, then maybe it would be a P wave or something like that state that could go too.
Okay. I would be invited.